WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How's this for an interesting job? Helping to solve crimes using cutting-edge science and animals. That's kind of the job description of my guest, Beth Wickdom. She analyzes animal DNA in cases where an animal has been the victim, the perpetrator, or a witness. Okay, the animal can't exactly take the witness stand, but you can prove that a suspect's clothes had traces of the fur, saliva, or urine of an animal that was at the scene of the crime. Beth Wickdom is the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. It's one of the largest animal DNA typing laboratories in the world. I asked Wickdom for a favorite crime story her lab helped solve. There's been so many, she found it hard to choose.
I think my favorite one, though, was a triple homicide case. And mostly it was my favorite because we didn't expect to get DNA results. In this instance, the person who was accused of shooting the three people claimed he had never gotten out of the vehicle, and they found a shoe impression in a pile of dog feces. So police submitted a piece of feces about the size of a pencil eraser that they had gotten from a shoe, and we were able to match that to the feces at the crime scene and place him at the crime.
Well, that's great. So he was convicted because of the DNA of the feces?
Well, that was a part of the evidence. In most of the cases, there's quite a bit of other evidence. You have witness statements, ballistics, and, you know, tire tread, the usual forensic evidence. And our DNA evidence plays a part of the total picture, just like as human DNA evidence would.
The use of human DNA in crime solving is pretty new. How did the use of animal DNA in crime solving get started?
Well, they went pretty much hand in hand. Along the same time that DNA tests were being developed in humans, our laboratory was also developing DNA tests in animals for use in verifying bloodlines in animals. We do a lot of horses, cattle, dogs, cats, llamas.
This is for breeders to make sure that the breed is...
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
We have contracts actually with different breed registries to do DNA profiling. So we had the marker panels in place. It's just the ability to take those panels and apply them in a forensic setting. We had a fair amount of experience with postmortem samples where breeders had neglected to DNA profile their animal before it died. And so in order to register the offspring, we had to get a DNA profile from the dead animal. So they were sending in all kinds of body parts. And we got pretty good at getting DNA out of very marginal samples.
Is it helpful when you want to get DNA, say, at a crime scene, is it helpful that animals tend to shed and lick and pee a lot?
It can be. Just like with humans, the best DNA from a hair sample is going to be if it has a root. But because animals do groom themselves, particularly dogs and cats, sometimes we will get DNA off hairs that you would not be able to get DNA from in a human situation. And we get DNA from a variety of other samples as well that they don't see so much in human work.
So what is the best material for animal DNA testing? If you had your choice of what specimen to use, what would it be?
Probably a hair with a big fat root. That would provide so much DNA, but those aren't the type of samples we usually get.
What do you usually get?
Again, there's such a variety. With human criminal work, a lot of times it's shed dog or cat hair because it transfers so easily from the victim to the suspect on their clothing, in their car, so on. If you know, have a pet, you know how easily it transfers. And also that's the most marginal type of evidence too, like I said, because it doesn't always have roots. But sometimes you get lucky and you get a result. Oftentimes too, we will get tissue. We're working on one case right now where there's actual animal parts. It's an animal abuse case. So unless it's been left out in the sun for a very long time in warm temperatures, it would be very good. There'd be lots of DNA there, no problem at all in getting a profile.
Do you often get calls from the police?
More and more we're getting calls from the police. Word is getting out that we're here and that we're doing this kind of work. A lot of times people didn't know that the lab was here, but they contact their veterinarians, their local universities, and we're getting more and more referrals from people like that.
Tell us about a case that you were called in on by a police unit.
Well, actually, this was one of our earliest cases. This was a sexual assault on a woman who was working in her yard, and a man pulled in a pickup truck and was asking for directions. And while he was talking to her, her dog urinated on his truck tire. And he dragged her into the truck, tried to sexually assault her, but she fought him off and called the police. And she was able to describe the truck to the police, but when they had him in a lineup, she couldn't pick him out. So the police came to us at that time and asked about doing DNA testing on the urine on the truck tire. So they swabbed it and sent it in, and we were able to match the DNA from the truck tire to the victim's dog, and again, placing him at the crime scene.
Truck tires are so filthy that I would have thought that the DNA evidence from the urine would have been corrupted in some way.
No, because the primers that we use are species specific, and so as long as the truck hasn't been sitting out in the rain or in the sun for very long, the samples were taken within a day or two of the assault, it would be fine. Mm-hmm. DNA is a very stable molecule.
Can you give us a sense of how long it takes to do a DNA profile and what that process is like?
Well, the process is going to vary according to the quality and quantity of the DNA. If you're dealing with shed hairs, it can be a lot longer than if you're dealing with a pulled hair with a root. We've had cattle cases come in and one day and go out the next, but typically we say to allow 4 to 8 weeks for testing. And if you're testing a case, for example, a dog attack case where there's large amounts of clothing that has blood, it has hair, it has saliva, it's even taken up to 3 months for testing in cases like that.
And why does it take so long?
Because there's so much evidence, and you're dealing with marginal evidence. We had one case, dog attack case, that was actually ended up being a homicide because they took the woman off life support. And in that instance, we tested her jacket because there was a lot of blood on it, and we could not get dog DNA. So we actually ended up reading in the newspaper the story of her assault, and they were told that she was attacked on the right leg. So then we had to go back, and we targeted the right leg and got a DNA profile. And in that case, the hospital had put the clothing in a plastic bag and left it at room temperature for a month before we got it. So it was just covered in mold. And so it was not an optimal evidence to work with.
Yeah, it also sounds really unpleasant.
There is that aspect, especially when we were doing post-mortem with the horses people would dig up. We would try to get them just to send in a tooth or two, but a lot of times they want to send a whole head or a whole leg, and we only need a little bit.
When you say send, exactly how do they send a specimen like a horse head?
FedEx.
Really?
Just wrap it up real well so it doesn't leak.
Wow. Do the FedEx people know that?
I don't think so.
Okay. And what's a good civil case that you worked on?
Well, we get a lot of civil cases that are just lost or missing animals. People want to know if a certain dog killed their cat. We get a lot of those. Actually, the most interesting ones are usually the ones where they end up being a surprise. Like, for example, there was one woman whose cat was killed, and she had seen the neighbor's dog in her yard several times, and they suspected it was the dog, so we tested it with our typical dog primers and didn't get results. We thought, what are we doing wrong? So we ended up backtracking and just doing a generic species identification test, and we came up with bobcat, which completely surprised everybody.
Did anybody know there were bobcats in the vicinity?
She didn't. But their property backed up onto a wildlife preserve.
Wow. So an innocent dog's life was spared.
In that case, yes. Yes, our own little innocence project.
My guest is Beth Wickdom. She's the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Beth Wickdom. She's the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. We're talking about her forensic work using animal DNA to help solve crimes. What's the bread and butter in your lab for animal DNA testing?
Well, the laboratory itself, like I said, does parentage testing. We are kind of a subunit of that laboratory that does the forensics. Bread and butter, probably the biggest component up until recently was cattle rustling. We've done quite a few cases from almost every state in the West, but again, we're sort of a victim of our own success because now when the brand inspectors tell the suspects they're going to get DNA testing, they usually end up working out a plea deal, so we never see the samples anymore.
So for cattle rustling, how would that work? What would your role be?
Well, cattle rustling has been on the rise since we banned Canadian beef, and the prices for U.S. beef have gone up. And typically the cattle that are rustled are calves that are unbranded. They may be out in the field standing next to a fence, and so they're very portable. Somebody could just take them up and throw them in the trunk of their car, and they sell for $400 or $500 a piece. So in those sort of instances, when they get calves that where the brands have been altered or they're unbranded and they don't have the correct documentation, they'll get suspicious. They'll call the brand inspector, and they will check with ranchers that have lost calves who will supply DNA from the cows, and then we'll get DNA from the calves and do a parentage analysis to see if they are indeed the offspring of those cows, and we can then return them to the ranch from which they were stolen.
In the forensic work that your lab does, was there ever any resistance? Were courts ever reluctant to accept animal DNA as evidence?
In my experience, they've been very generous in allowing animal DNA evidence in. I think we've benefited from the human DNA challenges that were experienced in the last decade. And so now human DNA is pretty well accepted, and we're using the same types of equipment, the same protocols to do animal DNA testing. So for the most part, it's very well accepted. I only know of one case where it was thrown out, and that we're not the laboratory that did the work in that case.
Have you ever gotten a call from Scotland Yard?
Yes, we have. Back in the year 2000 was the first time they contacted us. In that instance, a bouncer at a club had been stabbed in the heart, and there was a trail of blood leading away from the crime scene. But when they tested it, it wasn't human. So that's when they called us up and asked if we would do the testing. And at first we said no, but eventually they talked us into it. So they flew over for a week. Actually, in this instance, the person who originally contacted us got bumped by his supervisor, who decided to bring the samples to California for a week. And we did the testing, and we were able to match the blood on the sidewalk to the suspect's dog, who apparently, during the altercation, had gotten his ear nicked with the knife that was used on the bartender.
That's really interesting. You say at first your lab said no to this request from Scotland Yard. Why?
Well, at that point, we were just starting to dabble in the forensic field. It was becoming apparent that there was a need there, and we were getting started, but we weren't really set up as a forensic laboratory. And to deal with somebody like Scotland Yard is pretty intimidating. And so, but there wasn't really anybody at that time that could do the work, so they talked us into doing it.
So how did this case from Scotland Yard change the lab?
Well, it really validated to us that there was a need for what we were doing and that it was important work. And to work with somebody like Scotland Yard was great. I mean, there were wonderful people and very professional, and even though they were, like I said, intimidating.
You've been called in on a lot of animal abuse cases. What are the typical cases like?
There really is no typical case. We've done everything from testing sticks or weapons up into testing pieces of tissue. For example, one of our earliest animal abuse cases was what we call the puppy chopper, where a man was observed putting unwanted puppies into a chipper shredder. And the mother ran off with one of the puppies, and we were able to take tissue from the chipper shredder and match it to the mother to show that it was an offspring of hers. And in that case, the man got a couple years in jail. But the good thing is, in that case, the good part of it was that the mother and her puppy became poster dogs for animal abuse. And they were adopted by the veterinarian that was working on that case.
What a horrible story.
Yeah, sorry. A lot of the animal abuse cases are. We have another animal abuse case that was really interesting because in that instance, there was a case of serial abuse where they started out shooting hamsters, putting them in a pillowcase, having a fight with them. Then they escalated up to shooting a bull with some razor arrows. They killed a goat with a machete, and then they attacked some llamas with a meat cleaver. And then finally they attacked a llama and killed it with broken off golf clubs. And in that instance, we showed that the suspect had llama blood on his shirt, and they went to jail. But I'm particularly proud of that case because you could see the escalation, and an FBI profiler said this was the kind of person that would go on to eventually become a serial killer and attack humans, which indeed, when he was in prison, he talked about going on and killing orangutans and apes at Butchart Gardens.
Wow. This isn't the kind of work that really increases your faith in human beings, is it?
Not really. You see a lot of dog attacks, which can be vicious, especially on young children, but the dogs are acting instinctively. When you see what people do to animals that is just pure evil, it's horrendous.
Is there a particularly bizarre story you were called in on?
Well, we've had some bizarre requests. One that leaps to mind is some hair testing. We were asked to verify that the hair came from a Bigfoot. I told them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I told them that we could only tell them if it didn't come from a Bigfoot since we didn't have a positive Bigfoot sample to compare it to.
Well, that's a real flaw in your lab, isn't it, that you haven't got one yet?
Well, we're working on our Bigfoot database.
Do you have a file of unidentified DNA? Or like DNA that doesn't fit into any species that you know of?
I'm afraid not.
Maybe it is a Bigfoot. No?
No, no. There is a genetic repository called GenBank where DNA sequences are uploaded. So that's the first place you go to compare DNA sequences. And if it doesn't match anything in there, then it probably doesn't exist.
What got you into this work in the first place, and what did you expect you would be doing with the knowledge that you had?
Well, I never thought I'd end up here. I was a zoology major, and I went to work at the laboratory doing blood typing. And then as we started the DNA testing, I became very involved with that and developed a lot of the tests that we're using now. And when the forensics unit was started, I was asked to head that up. And so I had to learn forensics as I went. And so it's been interesting. It's been a real education. And like I said, we're always learning something new.
Do you have pets?
Yes, I do.
And what do you have?
I have a dog, and he's actually our positive control for the laboratory.
What does that mean?
Well, every time you run a sample, you have to run positive controls, which is a known, and negative controls to make sure that there isn't contamination. So he is our known sample that we run with every dog case.
I bet he'd be very proud if he knew that. So what did you get, good dog hairs with a root on them?
Actually, we do the same thing they do in the human world, which is we use what's called a buccal or a buccal swab, and it's just a swab on the end of a stick that you run in the suspect's mouth and collect epithelial cells from the inside of the mouth. Because DNA is DNA, and some people don't realize the DNA from your hair is going to be the same in your mouth, from your muscle.
So just curious, like with your dog, when you did the DNA testing, did you learn anything about your dog's breeding or heritage that was interesting to you that you didn't know before?
Well, I learned he's not wolf.
Did you think he was?
There was some question. I think he's part husky, and so he has that wolf look, and we didn't know where he came from. So we were able to eliminate the wolf and just show that he was dog. That's what every laboratory would like to do, is to develop a test that shows breed. And right now, there isn't any reliable test, because most dog breeds have evolved just within the last few hundred years, so they're not that genetically different. Between a Chihuahua and a Doberman, there's not that much difference.
Is there any reason why all of us who have pets should go out and get DNA specimens, or is that a kind of pointless exercise unless there's a good reason for it?
It doesn't take any effort to collect a DNA sample, and I always recommend people do it. You can just pull some hairs that have good roots. If it's an animal like a dog that typically sheds a lot, you can just get a cotton-tipped applicator, run it around their mouth about 10 times, and collect cells. Just let it air dry, put it in a paper envelope, don't put it in a baggie, and stick it in a drawer, and it'll be good for years and years and years. So if there's ever a question about your animal being stolen, you can always pull out a sample and have a known sample to compare it to.
Well, I never would have thought of doing that. Putting a swab in an envelope and keeping it there for years just in case. That's really interesting. Do you think more and more people are doing that now?
I hope so. It'd make our job a lot easier.
Would it?
Oh, absolutely. Instead of trying to get little pieces of hair or feces from the home, we could actually just test the swab and have a good DNA profile the first go round.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Beth Wickdom is the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.